Never acknowledge the fact that you're a girl and take pride when your guy friends say, "You're one of the guys." Tell yourself, "I am one of the guys," even though in the back of your mind a little voice says, "But you've got girl parts."
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. There's something about the West that draws artists of all sorts. Some have tried to capture the essence of the West through photos or paintings or songs, but today we're going to look at the writers who have been inspired by this place. The classic Western tale usually features a strapping cowboy, a damsel in distress, and an animal howling in the distance. But writer Craig Johnson has a slightly different and darker story to tell. He spoke with Think Why Radio's Emmy DeGrappa about how he started the Longmire series.
Our focus today is to talk to you about your personal journey as an accomplished writer and author. And how
That's making the assumption that I am an accomplished author and writer. So, as long as we're going to go from that point, okay.
Well, if you're a New York Times bestselling author, I think
oh,
I can say
that. Oh,
that
doesn't mean anything.
No, okay. Then we won't say that.
Okay.
But tell us how you got into writing.
You know what? It's interesting like that. I mean, because I didn't come from a wealthy background. We didn't even have a television. And one of the things we would always do is we would always go out on the front porch after dinner and tell stories, talk. For me, I think it was just a question of going from telling stories to writing stories. My education was actually in writing, but I didn't let that get in the way of becoming a writer. And then, in all actuality, there's only two honest answers to the question, how'd you become a writer? And the first one is that you run out of excuses. I built my own ranch. I mean, I poured the concrete, stacked the logs, built it all myself, got it all up and going like that, and then thought, okay, well, you've always wanted to be a writer. Now would be the time to sit down and actually write. Because I'm firmly of the belief that everybody has a writer inside them. The problem is they generally have an editor inside them, too, who strangles the writer to death before they get anything down on paper. And so I was able to wrestle that inner editor, to a standstill to actually get started on my first novel. And the other way you become a novelist is by coming up with a story that you think, needs to be told and that maybe hasn't been told before. And what I came up with is there was a young woman, a product of fetal alcohol syndrome up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, who's taken into a basement and abused by these four young men from an adjacent town. After 2 years, they basically get away with suspended sentences and then start turning up dead, shot with a .45-70 Sharps Buffalo rifle one by one. It's the worst nightmare of the sheriff of the least populated county and the least populated state in America, and that was The Cold Dish, the very first Walt Longmire novel.
So you started out, that was your first novel, was
Longmire?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. That was it.
So you jumped off the cliff.
I did. I really did. Like, and the books are written, in first person, So the way I write the books, it's almost as if you were to be sitting on a stool, at the Busy Bee Cafe in Durant, Wyoming, in the 24th County, Absaroka County, which does not exist. Don't look for it on a map. But you'd be sitting there at a stool, and all of a sudden the sheriff comes in and sits down on the stool next to you and says, "Let me tell you about what happened to me last month." And from that point in time, I don't want you to even remember that you're reading a book. I want you to fall into that world and be a part of it. It appears as though it's kind of struck a chord, because Walt is a little bit different from a lot of the protagonists that you tend to meet, not only in crime fiction, but also in Westerns, because generally they tend to be the 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal. Every woman wanted him. Every man feared him. He could kill anyone with a #2 Ticonderoga pencil in 3.2 seconds. And I hate that guy more than anybody else in literature or cinema. And so for me, I was looking for a different kind of guy to tell the story. I was looking for somebody who was like us, and I tend to refer to Walt as over. He's overweight, he's overage, he's overly depressed, but he still gets up in the morning and tries to do the job. And, to me, that's a true hero, that's dealing with all the problems that everybody deals with. And so he's that sadder but wiser sheriff that, to me, is a little bit more fun to hang out in the head of, for 400 pages than maybe that James Bond kind of character.
How many Longmire books have you written so far now?
I've written 11 Walt Longmire books, and then also there's a collection of short stories called Wait for Signs that came out last year, and then there was a little novella called Spirit of Steamboat that was actually the first one-book Wyoming state read for the state of Wyoming, which was very exciting for me to have that happen. I traveled around all over the state last year and went to 63 libraries in one summer, including Jackson. I was actually over here like that. And it was funny because, you know, whenever the state librarians got me started with the idea, they said, you know, well, we're going to send you, you know, like to Jackson and Casper and Cheyenne and Gillette and all the big towns. And I said, you know, I don't think it's fair that a guy from a town of 25 should only go to the larger towns in Wyoming. I said, you know, why don't we do it this way? Whichever you know, libraries request me, I'll go to them. Like that, well, 63 libraries requested me. And so that's how many libraries I went to in one summer.
Wow, that is wonderful. And then after you wrote your first book of mm-hmm. Longmire, why would someone pick that up and think that would be a success?
You know, I think that every day. Like, why would someone pick that up and try and make it a success? It was, but that's kind of your job as a writer, though, a little bit, you know, to the extent that it's like being a cop. When everybody's running in one direction, you need to run in the other. If, you know, you got this urge to write, you know, zombie vampire YA, you know, young adult literature, maybe you should drop that idea and do something different because that train already left the station. So I think, you know, the job of an author is to try and think of something new. Some new message, some new characters, some new design like that in which to encapsulate your writing like that. And so that's kind of what I did, you know, when I came up with that first novel. And then, of course, the first process in getting published is you have to have an agent. There's no way that any of the big publishers will ever accept unsolicited manuscripts anymore. They just, you know, over the transom, they just don't do it anymore simply because there are so many people attempting to try and get published like it. So it makes it a little bit difficult to, you know, introduce yourself in that fashion, like that, especially, you know, when you're from Ucross, Wyoming, to try and introduce yourself like that. But I was bold and actually went to New York. You know, I wrote a bunch of, made a bunch of phone calls like that to a lot of these offices in New York of these agents that I was interested in like that and told them I'm going to be in New York in these 3 days and I'd like to stop by and drop this manuscript off, which was a little bit more of an undertaking than perhaps it might seem because I think I made the biggest mistake that I think a lot of beginning authors make in the sense that I thought if I ever get this book published, nobody's ever going to publish anything else, so I'm putting everything in this book. So the first draft of The Cold Dish was something like 650 pages long. It was kind of like War and Peace in Absaroka County. And so they literally had to open the door a full 6 inches, you know, to let me slide it through the door before they slammed the door in my face and said, "We'll get in touch with you, kid," and I'm still waiting to hear from a lot of them like that. But there was one agent who gave me 10 minutes. She said, "I can give you 10 minutes, but that's all I can give you." And I thought, well, that's 10 minutes more than anybody else has given me in the last 3 days. So I'll jump on that like a dog on a bone. And I went in, sat down, talked with her like that. And she said, you know, well, tell me a little about the book. Tell me a little about yourself. And this 10 minutes turned into about 45 minutes. And when I got ready to leave, she said, "You know what, I've got to go to the Frankfurt Book Festival, so I'm not going to get a chance to read this right off, but I will read it, and I will give you a response," you know, which was more than anybody else was really willing to commit to. I thought that was great. Okay, and I got home, and by the time I got home, there was a message on the answering machine at the ranch, and it was the agent that I have now, and she said, "Don't give this to anybody else, I want it." And so she picked it up, and the first thing she said was, "You need to knock about 250 pages out of this thing," which I did. And then she handed it over to Catherine Court over at Viking Penguin. And Viking Penguin picked it up and said, "We'd really like some more of these." And I said, "Well, I'm happy to do some more books for you guys." And they said, "No, I don't think you understand. We would like some more of these. We think these characters, these relationships, this place, it has something to say about the contemporary American West. And we just would like some more novels out of this." You know, and that's when I, with the knowledge of not even having had one book published, started arguing with the president of Penguin USA, Catherine Court, and saying, "I don't think that's a good idea, but I got some other ideas I want to bounce off of you." And she said, "Why don't you go back to your ranch and think about this?" And I did. And every day the emails come in and the cards and letters and Warner Brothers with the television show and all of that and the New York Times bestsellers list for the last 5 years running like that. They were right and I was wrong. So
that is excellent. So that's kind of how it evolved into the television show series?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's how it all kind of happened.
So the publisher actually introduced it to television?
No, actually, no. Warner Brothers got in touch with me and said that they were thinking about doing a television show based off of the books. I mean, I'd been doing a little courting dance with Hollywood, you know, for a couple of years. A number of directors and actors and all these people had been in touch with me about doing a feature film based off of The Cold Dish. And so I'd kind of got my head wrapped around the idea that maybe someday it might, miracle of miracles, you know, be a feature film. But a good friend of mine, Donna Dubrow, who's a producer out in Los Angeles, like she said, you know, be careful about optioning your work, because an awful lot of the time what happens is it ends up in a manila envelope in some producer's desk and never again sees the light of day. And I really wasn't interested in the money part of it. I just wanted to maybe give some more visibility to the books. I'm a cowboy writer in a town of 25, and that's not going to change. So for me, it's always going to be about the visibility for the books. And she said, see if you can get a package deal from one of the studios, because what will happen then is they'll have the producers and the writers and the directors and everybody all in place, and then also provide the monetary funding to get a pilot actually done. And so I did, like that, and that was when Warner Brothers came out and said, you know, we'd like to do a TV show. And that was how Longmire got started.
How does that change your writing? Because really, they have to create a script based on the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do. Like, well, you know, it's according to how, you know, how involved you are with the process. And I've been very, very fortunate in the people that I work with, Greer Shepherd, you know, Hunt Baldwin, John Coveney, these people that were the producers of the show, really love the books, really love the characters, really loved, you know, the environs, you know, this least populated county in the least populated state in America. It's really kind of anti-CSI was what it turned out to be. And another thing is that, you know, I remember Greer talking about it, and she said, you know, we've kind of gone through this, like, you know, anti-hero thing since the 1960s, and it's done nothing but hyper-accelerate here in the last couple of decades to the point where you can't really tell the good guys from the bad guys. So I think, you know, that the viewership is really kind of looking for some guy who's got a code, you know, some guy that's a good guy. He's decent. He's kind, and he cares, you know, and he's capable, you know, and boy, she was right. It turned out that the TV show was the highest rated scripted drama that the cable network had ever had. And then we've got a new season coming out, the fourth season of Longmire coming out on Netflix. I believe the ballpark is end of August, beginning of September. So we're all pretty well excited about that.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking forward to that. Is there any advice you'd like to share with an aspiring writer?
Well, it's going to sound hokey, but, you know, you really got to follow your heart. You know, it's got to be something that really comes from deep inside and something that, you know, you're going to really feel strongly about continuing on. I mean, building my ranch was probably one of the best preparations that I had as far as becoming a novelist, you know, because, I mean, I stacked logs from dawn until dusk, you know, and here in Wyoming in the summertime, you know, dawn till dusk is like, you know, 5:30 a.m. until 10 o'clock at night. And I would turn around and look, and it didn't look like I'd done a damn thing, like all day. And so, you know, I kept thinking, you know, this is probably good for me to learn a little bit of patience as far as that's concerned. But, you know, you really got to have that jet fuel, you know, within you, a passion within you to write about something that you really feel is something you believe in, and a message that you're trying to get across that's strong and that you can, you know, they'll go the distance, I guess. And to use another horse analogy like that, I mean, you know, one of the things that you do as a writer is kind of judge your stories almost the same way that you would judge a horse. You know, I mean, there are going to be, you know, your short track horses, you know, good quarter horses that are good for short distance. You know, okay, that's a good short story or novella or something. And then you come across some of those ideas that are thoroughbred ideas, the ones that will really go the distance. And, you know, you got to stumble across one of those thoroughbreds. And once you do, boy, jump on and hang on tight.
Take off.
Yep.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure. There's not too many opportunities I get to talk about the actual process, you know, so this has been wonderful for me.
I think the process is important. About the humanities.
I do too. I agree.
That's author Craig Johnson speaking with Emmy DeGrappa of Think Why Radio. The story was produced by Nancy Clancy, and you can find more Think Why Radio produced by the Wyoming Humanities Council at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. The most recent book in the Longmire series, Dry Bones, came out last year, and the TV show Longmire has been renewed by Netflix for a fifth season. Storytelling has always been central to Native American cultures, but many of those stories could be lost. So in an effort to keep one native language and all it has to say alive, University of Colorado linguist Andrew Cowell and official interpreter for the Northern Arapaho tribe William C. Hare have put together a book of traditional Arapaho tales. They spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards about the history behind the stories in the anthology.
You know, many years ago when I was a child, there was no electricity on reservation, and And so you would be ready for bed. When you got ready for bed, well, then your grandparents would begin with stories. They would tell you the stories, and then their language was so eloquent, and you know, it was so descriptive that you can almost say that they told our stories in color.
Yes, and it seems like there's a lot of characters that reappear. So who are some of the characters that appear in these stories?
One of our favorite, you know, characters that we used to hear a lot about, you know, was even before the coming of the other types of people. You know, our favorite trickster was the white man.
That was
a trickster. In many of the stories, the white man always wants to outsmart some of the animals, or all the animals and the birds. But there's one thing that he cannot conquer, and then that was the coyote.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that a lot of these stories are very funny, and humor seems to play a big role.
There are, you know, they are very, very, one of the stories is where that the white man, the trickster, you know, sees this bird is sitting on a limb of a tree, and then it has an ability to throw its eyes out and then land on another tree, and that enables the bird to see what's on the other side while he is here. And today we can sit here and through the satellite, through the television, we can view what's happening in Iraq or whatever, but physically we are here.
And some of the stories, they're even a little body or naughty, I guess.
Yeah, we have some naughty stories. You know, we had the white man and his mother-in-law. In our tradition, a boy will never speak to his mother-in-law. There's a relationship there that they stay far apart. But this white man, you know, he had a mother-in-law, and then I guess she was very beautiful. So they climb on a hill. They start climbing on a hill, and his mother-in-law has long dress, but as they climb on the hill, he would step on it. And he would step on it constantly until they tear pieces of it. And pretty soon this white man starts to moan, and wondering, I said, what's the matter? He said, I'm very, very cold. I think I'm going to freeze. And then the mother-in-law says, well, come over and I'll warm you up. You know, that's what he wanted to do. I said, that's your naughty story.
But it's hilarious, and does it teach a lesson too? Is it kind of talk about that rule that?
Yeah, that's the traditional rule, you know, that was in place, worked for us, but not for the trickster, not for the white man.
Yeah, so maybe you can talk a little bit, and Andy, feel free to pitch in here. How much of the writing had been done in the past? How much of these stories had been preserved in writing?
Every story in the book is only in the book because it was preserved in writing. So, because otherwise, there are no recordings from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The technology just really wasn't there. So they had been written down by several different people using several different writing styles, but the problem with all of them was that the writing was not very clear. It didn't really capture all the Arapaho sounds very well. So our job was to go through all those manuscripts and try to figure out what in the heck they were actually trying to say in Arapaho and what they really meant in Arapaho and kind of bring it back to life. When I came up here, the tribe had already done a good deal of work on writing the language themselves and ended up writing a grammar. And now we're working on an ambitious dictionary. We really want to have a complete dictionary of the language, although that's never possible, but to get somewhere close to that.
Well, and I remember in reading it that some of the words are words that mean whole sentences. You know, how do you put together a dictionary when it's that complex?
Most of our verbs are one utterance, but it's a sentence. Like say, I am hungry. Has nano, you know, in English, it's got all of that. It's got the subject and it's got the action word, and then in our tenses, you know, we have the present. We have the past, we have the future, and we have an additional one that no others have is what we call a narrative past. The narrative past, you know, it denotes that the speaker don't have first-hand knowledge of what he's speaking about, so he makes that known. The listener, you know, that it's used quite often in our narratives, you know, because the speaker was not there when these stories were developed.
Did you want to add anything to that?
Well, just to say, yes, it is difficult to do a dictionary of Arapaho. I think people don't realize the fact that dictionaries, they were originally done for languages like English and German and French and Spanish, and they're actually a product of the structure of those kinds of languages where the words are isolated by themselves. And so you see a word, you just look it up. But in Arapaho, if I want to say I am walking, I say Jabisana. But if I want to say I walked in the past, I say Nih Jabisana. And if I'm going to say I'm going to walk in the future, I say Hat Jabisana. And then I could say, like, I'm going to start walking, Hat Chesis Jabisana. And that's all one word. And the word just gets longer and it adds prefixes. The problem for a user of a dictionary in a language like this is how to even find that word when it's kind of got three prefixes and two suffixes before and after it.
Yeah. Well, why, maybe just to wrap up, can you talk about why it is so important to preserve Arapaho?
Well, it is very, very important because, you know, identity of our people. Without the language, it is impossible to really interpret our life ways. So, you know, for people now, our young students, you know, that don't have the language, you know, they have a very low self-esteem and low concept of themselves. They don't know who they are.
We were talking earlier about the fact that there's an Arapaho story which would compare to Shakespeare or some of the great European literature, and I definitely think that's true. It's an incredibly rich and complex language, and these stories have developed over hundreds of years and become more and more tightly organized with more and more puns and jokes and lessons in them. Arapaho should be studied as a literature by everybody in the same way that we would study Italian literature and read Dante or German literature and, you know, read the great Romantic poets.
Well, I fully intend to take this book home and read some of these stories to my children, for sure. They're going to enjoy them so much.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards talking with linguist Andrew Cowell and Arapaho interpreter William C. Hare. The book is Arapaho Stories, Songs, and Prayers, a bilingual anthology. One of the stories in the anthology is the tale of a trickster and some plums. We'll hear it first in Arapaho, read by C. Hare, and then in English, read by Cowell.
So it's the trickster figure, Nihatha, and he's walking down along a river, and he's really hungry, and he's wondering what he's going to eat. So then he looks in the water, and he sees some plums, like, down in the water. And so he says, well, those look good. So he tries to reach in the water and get them, but he can't reach them far enough. So then he says, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tie some rocks on me, and that way I'm going to jump in the river, and you know, that those rocks will carry me all the way down to the bottom where I can get those plums. And then he ties these rocks on, and he jumps in the river, and then he goes down to the bottom, but he can't find the plums. And then the rocks finally come loose, and then he floats up to the top of the river again, and he's floating on his back, and he looks up and he sees the plums up above him, and they're on a tree, and he realizes that's where they were. So he gets out of the water and he goes and he eats those plums, and then he says to himself, gee, I don't know why I'm so crazy. And then he heads on down the river again.
Next, let's hear from Jackson Hole author Susan Marsh. Here, she reads from her memoir, A Hunger for High Country.
One day in the Gros Ventre wilderness many years ago, I startled a volunteer trail worker with my use of an uncommon word. In a soft southern accent, he tried to express the yen that had drawn him from Georgia to Wyoming to spend a summer repairing forest trails for $16 a day. Beyond the benefits of passing a season in wild country, he felt an urge towards service. Volunteering is something you just ought to do, he began. It's a duty. I don't know. It's citizenship, I offered. He stopped. I haven't heard that word since I was in the second grade. I nodded. Until the word bubbled into my own conscious mind, I hadn't either. But it was the exact word that we both had been looking for. Citizenship was one of those points on which we second graders were marked, and a category of achievement for which I once earned painted beads from the campfire girls. Back then, it meant compliant behavior and polishing one's saddle shoes before heading to school. The volunteer trail worker and I understood it differently as we spent the day sawing deadfall and refreshing water bars, sweating and laughing and pausing to admire the limestone cliffs towering above a field of wildflowers. How different that workday felt from the one before, when I'd banged for hours at a computer keyboard on yet another budget report. Compared to that cheerless exercise in bureaucratic busy work, this form of citizenship was play. Americans are easily absorbed by the next new mobile device or recreational toy, but sometimes we must return to our source, that the forests will endure to offer their magnificence to upcoming generations is a cause worthy of vigilance and devotion. These United States are blessed by public land, where the beauty of nature and the chance to get outdoors is available to all citizens regardless of social station. Here we experience the enduring wild, and where the wild endures, we touch our deepest selves and the deepest connections we have with our precious blue planet.
A Hunger for High Country is about how Susan Marsh's childhood love for nature led her to become a landscape architect for the U.S. Forest Service. On a wildflower walk, she talked about her years of struggle during a time when the Forest Service hired very few women.
So along here we have Oregon grape, bluebells, more. These are little rock crests that the hummingbirds particularly like. Oh, here's a favorite. This one is leopard lily. It doesn't look like much from the top. It's all green, but then when you turn it upside down... Well, I grew up in the 1950s and early 60s near Seattle, Washington, and right behind my parents' house was a pretty extensive woodland area, and so that was my backyard, my playground, and I climbed trees and I made forts and I did all the stuff the kids do. When I was 9, I came home from school one day and I saw there were pretty tall trees, and I could see the trees were kind of swinging around, and I'm going, oh gosh, an earthquake. And the ground isn't moving, but the trees are. And then I saw the bulldozer. And I did watch the bulldozer tearing apart the blackberry patch that my mom and I used to pick berries in, and my climbing trees and all this stuff. And, you know, a 9-year-old doesn't really get what's going on. And nobody bothered to tell me anything that was going on. And I was just hysterical. And I started waving my arms and shrieking. I went out after the workday was over and surveyed what was left, and I had a little pocket knife, and I was going to carve into this madrona tree, don't cut the woods down, you know, as if someone was ever going to see this. I realized how futile that was in some way. And I think that's what attracted me to going to work in conservation and also going to work for the public lands. I think the thing that turned me to geology was a professor I had who happened to be a young woman at a time when I think she was the only female faculty member. And it wasn't that as much as just her enthusiasm for her subject. She would wave her arms and talk about how beautiful the place was, and there's this great outcrop up the road and we have to go see it, you know. And I thought, boy, somebody who can get this excited about some sandstone, I thought there must be something more to this. So I did major in geology. Oh, and this one is one of my favorites. It's called meadow rue, and the leaves look kind of like a columbine, but look at these little, these are male flowers. And the anthers hang down, and they kind of remind me of little Japanese lanterns or something. My colleagues who graduated with me in geology almost all went to work for mining companies. And a lot of them would write back to me from places like Alaska and say, you know, I really have mixed feelings about this because I'm out here prospecting for some kind of mineral that's going to end up, if they find it, you know, ruining the place. And it's so beautiful. And I love what I'm doing, but what's the result of what I'm doing? And I thought, I really don't want to do that. I got to find something else. Toward the end of my undergraduate time, I met the man who is now my husband, and his sister worked for the Forest Service. She was paid to go hiking, basically, and I thought, this is the job for me. So I went to graduate school and got a degree in landscape architecture, and I think that is what really got me into the Forest Service. And so I started my first Forest Service job in November of 1980. And a lot of the people I worked with liked to joke around, and they treated me as a colleague, and it was fine. But there were a few that just, I think they felt like I shouldn't be there because I was female, or it was even more subtle than that. Everybody would stand up and go to lunch, and I'd be sitting there, you know, nobody'd say, hey, come on. And so I kind of got used to that, and I was already somewhat used to it because of I went into fields of study that were also mostly men. And after 2 years, I was ready to move on. So I started applying for jobs, and the one that I got was in Bozeman, Montana. That was in 1982. One of the first people I met when I got to the Gallatin National Forest was the hydrologist, and who I always considered a nice guy. And the first question he asked me was, are you a bra burner? And I'm going, what? What kind of a question is that? I finally figured out, you know, I was so flat-chested from the time I was, you know, in my teens. It's like I haven't known a bra since I was 14, and I didn't need it then. Then the problem became, okay, I was female and so were several other people who were also very interested in conservation. They didn't rubber stamp every timber sale that came along. And so a lot of us kind of got blackballed, and some of that was top management. I didn't see anything getting better. In fact, things were getting worse for me. A new forest supervisor came along and had a very us-them attitude about Forest Service employees versus environmentalists. And he saw me as disloyal. And I thought, okay, I gotta get out of here. Their circumstances made it possible for me to come to Jackson. Basically, I was recommended by one of those environmentalists, and instead of saying, oh, it's the enemy, he was saying, well, we want somebody like that. When I first got to this forest, I was the only person on the management team who was female. And several of the district rangers got out of their chairs to shake my hand, and I just about fell over. There was one woman who was chief for a short time. Women in regional forester positions are not uncommon anymore, and we have, in this forest and region, we have women both at our local forest and in the regional office. So, you know, that's changed. There's a lot of high-status women in the Forest Service now. Oh, that's called prairie smoke, and that's for the seeds that make these little feathery structures that look like smoke when you have a whole bunch. It's really important to stay with the mission, because I think the mission is such a worthy one. Clean water, clean air, healthy forests, products, yes, but also places for people to get away from even a small town like Jackson with all the noise and the commotion, to come out here on a trail and listen to the water and the birds. I mean, that is such a gift. And this one is called Sugar Bowls. And another common name for it is Grandma's Nightcap, because it kind of looks like, you know, an old nightcap. But that's another favorite early flower.
To wrap up, let's hear from one more woman writer in the Mountain West. Tamara Lindsay grew up on a ranch in northern Wyoming, and she channels that experience in her collection of short stories, How to Be a Man. Lindsay told me the stories grew out of her own struggles with identity and gender.
There are a lot of women in the West who want to be men because they look around themselves and they see that being a man is the way to have respect. Women don't have respect, and so they do everything they can to try and be a man. They wear men's clothes, they watch a lot of football, they drink beer, they hunt, they drive pickup trucks. And there's nothing in and of itself that's bad about that. I think that's wonderful if that's what they want to do. But a lot of times, on the inside, they're denying who they essentially are. So they look at men and they go, okay, how can I be a man? Well, they can't actually be a man, but they're definitely not a woman because women have no respect. And so they think of themselves as this weird third gender almost. And that's detrimental if you deny who you essentially are. You spend all your time and all your energy working against yourself.
This seems like a good place for you to read the very opening of the book. If you could read that first paragraph.
Never acknowledge the fact that you're a girl and take pride when your guy friends say, you're one of the guys. Tell yourself, I am one of the guys, even though in the back of your mind a little voice says, but you've got girl parts.
And this really gets at what you're saying, that masculinity becomes a standard. And this book is not only about girls and women. There are also male characters. But regardless of the sex of the character, they're denying or struggling with accepting their feminine side.
Yeah. I was thinking in a broader sense that it's about self-acceptance in general. They're trying to find a place in the world where they can have self-respect or where they can connect with other people. Often the stories are about little moments, the small moments when we just have a small connection with someone, or the small moments where we do small violences to each other.
Another theme seems to be this idea that work and societal roles matter more than who we are as individuals. So this idea that doing is more important than being.
Absolutely. That's a very strong idea that I grew up with, and I think it's very strong in the West, that we get our self-worth by what we accomplish, by what we can contribute. I know in my own life, it took me a long time to get over that, you know, a lot of my self-worth wasn't just what I could accomplish. And it makes sense. I mean, your survival in the West depends on how much you work and how much how much fence you can fix and how much you can, you know, go out in the storm and take care of a cow that's calving. It's very, very intricately linked to each other.
You say it's taken a long time to overcome.
Yes.
That. How have you done that?
I think by first initially accepting the fact that I am female, and I can be proud of that. I am proud of that. I accept who I am now. And I think it helped coming to college, coming to the university. I started questioning things that I took for granted, that I just assumed about life, and that really helped me to understand and have self-worth.
So, Tamara Lindsay, how has your family reacted to reading these stories inspired by growing up on a ranch? Because there's a real closeness to this ranch life. I mean, these are vignettes mm-hmm. from the Western life, from Wyoming and for the most part. And there is an affection, certainly, in them. But there's also a distance and also sort of, you know, that critical distance.
I think that's the story of my life, is I'm ambivalent about my upbringing. I mean, I love it when I think about the Pryor Mountains and being out on a horse. It is so beautiful up there. I love it in so many ways, but also I hate it. I mean, there was so many challenges, certainly gender, but all kinds of other challenges as well. I mean, I was in between generations, so I was alone a lot. I didn't have a lot of friends, and I was intensely lonely. And so I am deeply ambivalent about the whole thing. And so I think my family has always known that I was ambivalent about it. You know, I do not romanticize the cowboy life.
You've talked about how college opened your eyes. Who's this book meant for? Who should read this?
It's easy to say everyone, but
that's good for sales.
That's good for sales. It's interesting. I did a Goodreads giveaway of the book, and I'm giving away 20 copies. And people signed up from across the world, you know, Mauritius, India, Indonesia, Great Britain, all kinds of places. I think the myth of the cowboy is infinitely attractive to everybody in the world. But there's other parts of the whole Western cowboy society that hasn't been explored and hasn't been talked about very much. And so I think it's for people who are looking for the West today, what the legacy of that cowboy way of life is, women and men. And also, there's some class and economic stuff going on. I mean, there are people who are really trying to make it, and they might see themselves in this book.
These gender issues that you explore in How to Be a Man, are these Western gender issues, or are they more universal?
They're certainly Western, but they are more universal. Malcolm Gladwell has a great book. He talks about how herding societies have this masculine-dominated mindset. And there's a whole series of sort of characteristics that go along with this. And the West certainly is a herding society, has the legacy of a herding society. And it has all these characteristics he talks about. There are some great things about that legacy as well. I mean, we have some men who are very tough. We have women who are very tough. We had to be in order to be able to make it. But then again, it's got its dark side, which is that the individual, the personal, the emotional gets left behind.
Tamara Lindsay is the author of a new collection of short stories, How to Be a Man. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's been such an honor. Thank you, Micah.
And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Raina Bush produced this podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.